Welcome to Creative Codex. This is the final episode of my Immaterial series about the artist Marina Abramovich. If you have not yet listened to parts 1 and 2, I strongly encourage you to pause this episode and enjoy those first. You can find them in the podcast feed by scrolling down to episodes 36 and 37. They'll give you a strong foundation for what's to come. Now, let's set the stage for this episode. Marina Abramovich is born on November 30th, 1946. In Belgrade, Yugoslavia. At the age of 6, she begins making art, and already has a distant dream in mind for becoming an artist. Her passion for painting is encouraged by her mother, Danica, whom she lives with, and who is otherwise incredibly strict and emotionally cold. In 1970, at the age of 24, Marina becomes active in the art community of Belgrade. Joining 5 other artists, they become loosely referred to as the Group of 6. The group hosts performances at the local student cultural center, and in 1973, at the age of 27, Marina performs her first official solo performance piece called Rhythm 10, the one with the knives, during an art festival in Edinburgh, Scotland. This is followed by 4 more pieces, all grouped in what is known as her Rhythm series, culminating in her now legendary performance of Rhythm Zero in 1974 in Naples, Italy, where Marina is used, manipulated, and abused by the Italian crowd for hours. In December 1975, Marina performs an intense new piece called Thomas Lips at the De Appel Gallery in Amsterdam. It's here that she meets the artist Ulay, who tends to her wounds after the performance. They immediately bond over the dozens of things they have in common, including their birthday, and most importantly, their vision for a new immaterial art. Marina flees Belgrade, moves in with Ulay. They fall madly in love, and in 1976, they perform Relation in Space at the Venice Biennale. It is their first collaborative work together, one of many in what will be known as their relational works, exploring the dynamics of male-female relation. In 1977, they buy a Citroën van, abandon the apartment and all material possessions, and choose to live on the road for the next 3 years. Ulay and Marina travel to any museum or gallery that will allow them to perform, in any country they can drive to. It's during this time that they write the Art Vital Manifesto, which is a list of principles that they follow in their art and life. Marina writes, "The audience saw separation, but in our lives, we were closer each day. Even our hair was exactly the same length. Often we tied it back in just the same way. We were becoming a kind of melded personality. Sometimes we called each other glue. We were happy, so happy that it's hard to describe. I felt we were really the happiest people in the world. We had next to nothing, almost no money, and we were going wherever the wind blew us." Unquote. They do several performances in 1977 in various countries, including the momentous work Expansion in Space, which they perform in an underground parking garage in Kassel, Germany, after being denied participation in the Documenta Festival. The performance draws an audience of 1,000 people. It is also the first time that Marina keeps going after Ulay stops. And with that, the stage is set. This is Codex 38, Marina Abramovich, Immaterial, Part 3, Sublimation. Let's begin. Chapter 4. That Self. The year is 1979. After living in their van, performing their art, and traveling Europe for 3 years, Marina and Ulay decide to lease an apartment. They have saved up some money from their performances and grants from the Dutch government, enough to afford a low-ceiling loft space, in a warehouse building near the Amsterdam harbor. Marina writes about it in her autobiography, Walk Through Walls. She states, along with several friends, we leased the entire third floor of Zoutkiesgracht, 116/118. It was a singular place, occupied by singular people. The floor plan consisted of four rooms. We used these as bedrooms, surrounding the middle space, which served as a living area slash kitchen. We fashioned a shower by attaching a hose to the kitchen faucet. You bathed standing in a bucket in the middle of the floor and spraying yourself with the hose. The building's elevator ran right through the center of the room, so sometimes people going to another floor stopped on ours by mistake while someone was taking a shower. Although this apartment marks an end to their Art Vital manifesto years, this isn't a change of heart. They have no plans to abandon their passion or to stop performing. Instead, this is a moment to regroup and start a new chapter in their life and work. Marina is nearing 33 years now, and Ulay 36. And besides, it's kind of nice to be able to sleep in a warm room for a change. They've certainly earned it. One winter, when they were traveling in Switzerland, the van doors froze shut so tightly overnight that they were trapped inside and had to breathe on the door handles to thaw themselves out. Although Marina and Ulay still carry the spirit of their Art Vital days, the focus of their work is now shifting to a new immaterial vision, one which emerges not from a set of principles, but from the result of their combined consciousness, a kind of third being from the two. Around this time, Marina states this at an art festival. Our interest is symmetry between the male and female principle. With our relation work, we cause a third existence which carries vital energy. This third energy existence, caused by us, does not depend on us any longer, but it has its own quality, which we call that self. Three as a number means nothing else but that self. Immaterially transmitted energy causes energy as a dialogue from us to the sensibility and mind of an eyewitness who becomes an accomplice. We chose the body as the only material which can make such an energy dialogue possible. Ulay and Marina become fascinated by the unconscious and the possibility of exploring it with their new work. It's interesting to note that in Marina's earliest works, in her rhythm series, the focus was on the loss of control and even on unconsciousness. But now, with Ulay, the focus is on the unconscious mind as a source of inspiration and mystery. It's an important distinction. It can't be denied that the overall influence that they have on each other is a life-affirming one. The work they perform is certainly less self-destructive, but still richly symbolic. That same year, they start visiting a hypnotherapist. In these hypnosis sessions, the therapist puts them both into a hypnotic state and asks them questions about their artwork and their collaboration. The sessions are recorded over a period of 3 months. Ulay and Marina then listen back to the tapes. The imagery and the ideas they hear themselves speak about inspire them to create four new pieces. Three of which will be for video playback, and one which will be performed for an audience. In the book, When Marina Abramovich Dies, the author, James Westcott, describes the three video pieces. Writing. In the 9-minute video, Nature of Mind, Abramovich stands for a few minutes on the edge of a canal with her arms held aloft. Then suddenly, there is a flash of color as Ulay falls, apparently from the sky, in front of Marina, and splashes into the canal. The movement takes only a few frames of the 16mm film's 23 frames per second. This is the nature of mind, according to the Zen Buddhism, that Abramovich and Ulay were interested in. Best let go. In the piece Point of Contact, Abramovich and Ulay stand face to face, locking eyes, and simply point at each other's index fingers, with only a minuscule gap between them, for 6 minutes. In one hypnotherapy session, Marina had a vision of how she would like to die, by rowing a boat toward a misty horizon and disappearing. The piece, Timeless Point of View, is a dress rehearsal for this death scene. Abramovich rows a boat on a large lake in central Holland, while Ulay stands on the shore, watching her fade into the distance and listening on headphones to the radioed sounds of the oars slapping the water and Abramovich's heavy breathing. The fourth piece that came from these hypnotism sessions is called Rest Energy. In my opinion, it's the most captivating one. Marina and Ulay perform this piece for an audience in August while in Dublin. They sport matching haircuts, which look like short-length haircuts common in the 1980s. They wear matching outfits. Marina with a white button-up shirt, the sleeves rolled up, a medium-length black skirt, and black flats. Ulay with a similar white button-up shirt, sleeves down, black trousers, and dress shoes. Marina holds the center of a large recurve bow with her left hand. Ulay is facing her less than 2 feet away. He loads an arrow against the bowstring with his right hand and begins to pull it back. The arrow is pointing straight into Marina's heart. As Marina holds the grip of the bow and Ulay holds the arrow loaded on the bowstring, they both slowly begin to lean backward. Their bodies create a V-shape in the negative space between them. The arrow cuts that space with deadly intent. If Ulay loses his footing, lets go, or even coughs, the arrow will slip from his fingertips and shoot from the taut string into Marina's chest. If Marina loses her grip, or lets go, she may let go of the bow and also cause the arrow to launch toward her. For this piece, Marina and Ulay are both wearing microphones under their shirts so that their breathing and heartbeats are amplified in the performance space. As their fingers and arms begin to struggle to keep a grip on the arrow and bow, their heart rates increase and their breathing becomes panicked. About 3 minutes in, Ulay's hand is shaking and his voice lets out painful groans. He is holding both their weight by only the two fingers of his hand that keep the arrow in place. They make it to the 4 minute mark and end the performance. Afterward, a journalist asks Ulay, "Why was the arrow pointed at Marina's heart and not at yours?" He responds, "Her heart is my heart." There is a further layer to rest energy, which adds even more symbolism. Marina and Ulay share a birthday, November 30th, making them both Sagittarius, the mythical archer with a bow that never fails to hit its mark. Rest Energy completes their new four-piece series, which explores unconscious material and the self that is created from the interplay between their individual points of consciousness. They edit the four performances, Nature of Mind, Point of Contact, Timeless Point of View, and Rest Energy, into an art film, which they title That Self, and they screen it for an audience later that summer in Amsterdam's Vondelpark. But on looking back on this work, years later, Marina admits the symbolism of the pieces goes even deeper, in a prophetic sense. In a moment of candor, she admits this: "My work and my life are so connected, and throughout my career, I've produced works whose unconscious meaning only becomes clear to me over time. In Point of Contact, we were so close, and yet, that final tiny space between us, the gap that ultimately prevented a merging of our souls, was unbridgeable. In Rest Energy, Ulay possessed the power to destroy me and to literally break my heart. In Nature of Mind, he was a brief but very important passage in my life, one that blew through like a flash because the emotions were so strong. And then, just like that, vanished definitively. And Timeless Point of View is unavoidably connected with the memory of my father teaching me to swim. It doesn't matter that in real life, he was the one rowing into the Adriatic, threatening to disappear as I struggled through the water toward him. In the work, I've corrected the past, making myself the powerful and independent one. Ulay is reduced to being a helpless onlooker as my destiny removes me from him. I realize that this is a theme I return to constantly. I'm always trying to prove to everyone that I can go it alone, that I can survive, that I don't need anybody. And this is also a curse in a way because I'm always doing so much, at times too much, and because I have so often been left alone, as I wished in a way, and without love." In Marina's view, on looking back at these works, she admits that something was sneaking out of the unconscious, some aspect about their relationship or her psychology, which was not immediately obvious to either of them at the time, but which would keep showing itself as a problem time and again in the work to come. Chapter 5, Dreamtime. Performance art was at its peak in the 1970s. It was the new medium audiences were intrigued by, and artists loved to discuss and debate. But there was one obvious problem. How do you make a living as a performance artist? What is the product you're selling? The art industry is run by big money. It's where the mega-rich park their millions with the knowledge that they will resell those artworks years later, making substantial profits. For example, in 2021, the US art market's sales totaled $28 billion. That's an unfathomable sum. To give some perspective, try to conceptualize this. 1% of 1 million is 10,000. 1% of 28 million is 280,000. Now, 1% of 28 billion is 280 million. We're talking insane amounts of money here. So, what is the product they are buying and selling? As a painter, your product is a painting. As a sculptor, it's a sculpture. As a photographer, it's photographs. As a performance artist, it's a fleeting moment of time in which something immaterial is conveyed. Yeah, try and repackage that and sell it. By its very nature, it's not intended to function within the billionaire art market. Like Marina Andulai's Expansion of Space performance proved, it's an art of the underground, meant for public parking garages with no admission fee. And so it made sense when the 1980s rolled around that the performance artists of the 1970s stopped performing and instead turned to those well-established mainstays of the art market. Painting and sculpture, things billionaires can easily purchase and store in airtight vaults. And can you blame them? These artists needed to make a living too. Many of them were entering their 30s and 40s, had made a name for themselves, and now capitalism was knocking on their door with a very handsome offer. And this offer swayed countless artists, but not Marina Andulai. Here were two people who had just lived in a van for 3 years, with hardly enough money to buy gas, who knit their own sweaters and showered in service stations, not for the sake of being frugal, but for the sake of art. Andulai once said in an interview, "I am very unorthodox, both in my life and work. I never did what artists are supposed to do. I don't follow the market. I don't have a signature style. I am more project-oriented." Unquote. In another interview, he admits, "We wanted to change things, to bring the humane aspects, the social dimension, into the art establishment." Marina also writes of this time, saying, "As all this was going on, Andulai and I were looking for a solution, new ways to make performances. I had no desire to go back to painting, and he had no wish to return to photography. So we said, let's go to nature. Why don't we go to the desert? We always used to joke that Moses, Muhammad, Jesus, and Buddha all went to the desert as nobodies and came back as somebodies. So there must be something in the desert." Unquote. Now, they weren't talking about just any desert. They were thinking about the Australian outback. Their fascination with Australia started from a brief visit in 1979, when they were invited to perform an original piece called The Brink at the Sydney Biennial. But even more than the country or the desert, Marina Andulai were most intrigued by the native inhabitants of Australia, the Aborigines, a people who truly lived an immaterial life, from generation to generation, one which even outdid their own. Historians believe that the Aborigines of the Australian outback have inhabited that land for over 40,000 years. What could Andulai and Marina learn from them? Would they be able to survive the demands of desert living? And how would the experience influence their performance art? In October 1980, they pack their bags, sell the van, and take a flight to Australia. Their plan is to meet with a contact first, a man named Philip Toyne, who is an activist lawyer. Toyne works on land rights cases for the Aboriginal tribes. He cares deeply for their sovereignty and their right to keep their land. Because of this, he is also very guarded about who he allows access to the Aborigines themselves. To help convince Toyne, before Marina and Andulai left, they filed a proposal to the Australian Visual Arts Council, stating they would like to live with the Aborigines in the outback for 6 months. And in return, afterward, they will travel around Australia for another 6 months, giving talks about their time in the desert and performing any new pieces inspired by the experiences. The proposal is accepted, and a generous grant is given to them. Their plane lands in Sydney, Australia. The adventure begins. Marina and Andulai buy a used Jeep and stock up on the gear they will need for 6 months in the desert. Their destination, Alice Springs. Sydney is on the eastern coast. Alice Springs is in the center. They will need to travel over 1,700 miles. But if there's anyone who can make the trip, it's these two. In a sense, their years of living in a van and driving around Europe have uniquely prepared them for this. Their journey takes them 2 weeks. When they finally arrive, they head to Philip Toyne's office, the activist lawyer who they know can get them access, and introduce them to an Aborigine tribe. After all, they can't just aimlessly drive into the desert, hop out at the first sign of natives, and expect everything to work itself out. Toyne is impressed that they came all this way, and that they have an accepted proposal from the Australian Visual Arts Council, but he is still hesitant about the arrangement. He has seen his fair share of blood-sucking tourists come through town who just want some photo ops with the Aborigines, and then they fly back home pleased with themselves. Marina and Ulay make a deal with him. Toyn is working on a book about Aboriginal land rights to present to the Australian government. They will help him. Ulay is a photographer, and he can also make maps, and Marina can do graphic design for the book. He agrees. The map-making was a particularly important task, because the modern maps were mostly from the 1950s and drawn out by the British government. There was no mention on these maps of any ancestral sites, trees, or rocks which were sacred to the local tribes, but which would mean nothing to foreigners. At one point in their mapping, Ulay becomes obsessed by a dingo fence. This impressive fence cordoned off southwest Australia to protect the sheep. They drive alongside this fence for days and days as it stretches into the horizon for 3,300 miles. This reminds him of the Berlin Wall, but also of the Great Wall of China. Marina recounts, "We spent the next month driving around with Philip, mapping and photographing the region. Every night we returned to Alice Springs and ate in one of the three restaurants with Philip and his friend Dan Vachon, a Canadian anthropologist. We stayed in the broken-down motel that served as Toyn's headquarters. It was quite an unusual place. Snakes would appear in the room frequently, and gigantic spiders. There was no air conditioning, and my God, it was hot. Autumn in the northern hemisphere is spring below the equator, and central Australia was starting to heat up. Daytime temperatures in the outback can approach 45 degrees Celsius, close to 115 degrees Fahrenheit." Unquote. The author, James Westcott, spoke with Toyn, who said this of Marina and Ulay. "They were very stimulating and interesting people, but they had a sense of reality that didn't match mine. I found it really hard to understand what their artistic endeavor was all about." Unquote. Nevertheless, after a month of helping Toyn with mapping the local terrain and preparing his book, he grants them permission to venture to the South Stations, a territory that is inaccessible to tourists or locals. He is finally going to personally introduce them to an Aborigine tribe. Marina, knowing that she'll effectively be living in an unreachable dimension for the next 6 months, writes a letter to Danica, her mother. She says, "Today is our last day in civilization, and I will write you again at the end of the year. In any case, I live a very healthy life, much better than in the city. The nature here is incredibly beautiful. We eat rabbits, kangaroos, ducks, ants, worms that live in the hollows of the trees. This is pure protein and is very healthy. On my feet, I have canvas boots, which are very good protection from snakes and spiders. This year, we will celebrate our birthday in the desert around the fire. I will be 34 years old and Ulay 37. I never felt as young in my life as I do now. Traveling makes a person young because he doesn't have time to get old. The temperature at the moment is 40 to 45 degrees Celsius. We are really feeling this temperature. We sleep under the open sky full of stars. We feel like the first people on this planet." Unquote. Now it's time for a brief intermission. At this point of the episode, in most podcasts, you'd hear an ad for Alpha Male Foot Cream, or glow-in-the-dark truck nuts, or the new trend sweeping TikTok, laser nipple removal. Come on, you're not using them. But not on Creative Codex. Instead, I'm going to say thank you. Thank you for being a listener of this show. Thank you to everyone who rates the show on Spotify. Thank you to everyone who reviews it on Apple Podcasts. And thank you to everyone who writes to me on Instagram, in emails, or on my Patreon. You really have no idea how much these kinds of messages and letters brighten my day. And sometimes they even make my week. Thank you. If you want to stay up to date with everything Creative Codex, you can now sign up for our newsletter. It gets sent to your email only once a month, and it keeps you in the loop on all the things you might be missing, including a reminder about the new episode releases. Creative Codex is more than just a podcast about the history of creative geniuses. It's about the story of creativity. As such, sometimes I make a video for the Creative Codex YouTube channel, sometimes I write an essay, other times I might create an exclusive minisode on my Patreon that I want to share freely. All of these things I put into this little Codex news email that goes out once a month. Add to that, I plan on writing a book related to the show, releasing a new soundtrack, and eventually hosting a live show. If you are subscribed to Codex News, it's a guarantee you will be one of the first people to hear about those things. Head on over to mjdorian.com/mail to sign up. That's mjdorian.com/mail. The link is also in the episode description. I promise, no spam, no BS. Without further ado, it's time to get back to Codex 38, Marina Abramovich Immaterial, Part 3, Sublimation. Toyn, the activist lawyer, introduces Marina and Ulai to two tribes, who they'll be staying with during their time in the Outback, the Pijanjada and the Pintupi. Being in the sweltering heat of the desert was a system shock, but entering into the daily life of these two tribes is a culture shock. Everything in their culture is different. For one, Marina and Ulai become separated immediately, because Aborigine men and women in these tribes keep both sexes apart. In rare occasions, they come together, such as on the full moon, when a man and woman can make love, and then they separate again. Even child rearing is different. When a child is born, any woman in the tribe who has milk can breastfeed the infant. Despite these separations in roles, women are not thought to be subordinate to men. Instead, both sexes have very specific functions in the community. Men tend to the larger game hunting, while women do the foraging for fruits, plants, seeds, and hunt small animals. Men scout terrain, track animals, make knives and spears, and learn about the ancestral beings in the land. Women use their knowledge of plants to create medicines and examine the dreams of the tribe. There is a perfect balance in their roles. Men have certain ritual ceremonies which women cannot attend, and women have certain ceremonies and rituals which men cannot attend. And then there are gatherings concerning the shared discussions of dreams, which all can attend. But there are also more immediate elements of daily life that give a foreigner this feeling of culture shock. Marina writes, "It wasn't just the heat that was shocking. Nothing prepares you for the ubiquitous dirt and the overwhelming smell and the swarming, clustering, relentless flies of the outback. And nothing prepares Westerners, even Westerners used to extreme experiences, for meeting Australia's first inhabitants. Aborigines are not just the oldest race in Australia. They are the oldest race on the planet. They should be treated as living treasures, yet they are not. There is, at first, zero communication with them. Tribal Aborigines don't talk to you because they don't communicate in the way that we are used to. It would take me 3 months to discover that they were actually speaking to me, in my head, telepathically. That was when everything would start opening up to me. But you have to spend at least 3 months climbing this wall, which most Australians don't. They would rather go to Paris or London than to the desert. And then there's the smell. The Pijanjada and the Pintupi don't wash with water. For one thing, because there isn't much water in the desert. But for another, because they don't want to bother the rainbow serpent, the all-powerful creator god who lives around the water holes. Instead, they use ashes from their fires to wash themselves, and it doesn't deodorize them. To a Westerner, this scent is unbearable. Smelling it is like taking a raw onion and rubbing it on your eyes." Unquote. Marina mentions some form of wordless communication that the Aborigines have, which takes her 3 months to learn. This is also around the time that she stops noticing the Aborigines' smell. I imagine that's probably because she smells like them at that point. Marina gives an example of this wordless communication, saying, "One night, around the same time that the flies went away, I was sitting around the fire with some tribeswomen when I noticed that they were talking in my head. We were not speaking, but they were telling me something. I was thinking, and they were answering me. That was when my mind really started opening. I began to notice that we could sit around in total silence and have a full conversation. For example, if I wanted to sit in a certain place next to the fire, one of the Aborigines would tell me in my head that this was a bad spot and I should move. And I would move, and nobody had spoken one word. Everything was understood." Unquote. Another shocking element, which they did not expect, was the desert heat. It was often unbearable, especially as spring turned to summer, and the heat during the daytime would rise above 50 degrees Celsius. That's 130 degrees Fahrenheit. She states, "It's like a hot wall. If you just stand up and walk a few paces, your heart feels like it's going to hammer through your chest. You can't. There are very few trees. There's very little shade of any kind. So you literally have to be motionless for long periods of time. You function before sunrise and after sunset. That's it. To stay motionless during the day, you have to slow down everything. Your breathing, even your heartbeat." Unquote. Marina says that her strongest memory of the desert is of this motionlessness. All of these elements combined, in both Marina and Ulay's experiences, color their time there with a dreamlike aura. In the rare moments when they spend time together, they take photographs of each other, just like old times when they documented the start of their relationship because it felt like something monumental. Now they document this experience living with the Aborigines because it feels consequential. Marina takes one photograph of Ulay that shows him on his hands and knees, like an animal, with his head turned close to the ground, as he sips from a wide puddle of water on the desert floor. This is a different reality, with its own rules. Countless times, things happen which cannot be logically explained, not with the standard tools of reason we're accustomed to. Things which truly seem to confirm this abstract concept of dream time, which is so difficult for foreigners to comprehend. It is said that Aborigines do not acknowledge a past or future. They live in an infinite present, where all of the ancient spirits and gods exist. Each day is a new day, a rebirth. Marina's role among the women is to help them present their dreams. They go to a field every morning, and every woman, starting from the oldest to the youngest, describes her dreams from the night before, and draws them in the dirt with a stick. The women present then act out the dream as it is described. Marina keeps a thorough dream journal, in which she writes every morning. Sometimes her dreams are prophetic. She has a vision of someone shooting the Pope. 48 hours later, someone tries to shoot Pope John Paul II. In November, she has an intense dream of an earthquake, which she narrowly escapes. She tells Ulay the next morning. The following day, Marina visits the activist lawyer and asks him about any news in the world. He tells her there was a massive earthquake in Naples, Italy. 1,000 people died. Another time, January, she has a vision of her bedroom back in Amsterdam, with the bed next to the window instead of the corner. A friend named Marinka is staying at their place while they're gone. She makes a note in her journal. Strange image. How great that she put her bed next to the window. A year and a half later, when she asks Marinka about it, it turns out that she had taken a trip to Belgrade at that time and rented the place to a Swedish couple. The first thing they did was move the bed next to the window. You know, when these types of experiences keep piling up in your day-to-day life, there comes a point when it becomes irrational to think they're all just coincidences, right? What is causing this shift in quality of her consciousness? Perhaps it's all the factors combined. The intense heat, the profound stillness, the all-natural diet, the sacred desert, and the customs of the Aborigines. Even engaging in one of these aspects would shift your consciousness, but Marina and Ulay are immersed in several. For example, when Marina first joined the tribeswomen at the start of the 6 months, she was experiencing unbearable migraines because of the heat. Ulay convinces her to see the medicine man. Here's Marina's journal entry from that time. Note that she uses the nickname Glue for Ulay in this entry. It's a nickname they have for each other. She writes, December 11th, 1980, Papua, Australia. Glue and Andrew Cocker told me they met with the medicine man and arranged everything. I don't believe them at first, but they convince me and tell me to come with them at once. This is what I've always wanted, but now I'm scared. He is called the Tongue of the Blue Lizard. That name, that picture, seems familiar. He touches me with his fingers. I feel an electricity inside my skull. He places his lips on my right temple and sucks and spits and sucks and spits. When he has finished, he shows me the cup full of his spit and some blood. All of that he sucked out of my head. He tells me that there was a battle between my left and my right side in my head. But all is good now. That whole day and the day after, I felt indescribably strange. There is a pale blue stain on my head where his lips were, and nothing more. I know that something irrational happened to me. Some other powers are at play here, of which my race still knows nothing. Unquote. Ulay becomes very close with the tribesmen he is staying with. They give him a name. Chungurai. He doesn't know what it means, but it indicates he is on the path toward initiation. One rare time, Marina and Ulay spend a day together. While the moon rose overhead, they conceived of a new art piece, to walk the Great Wall of China. Both of them would start from opposite ends of the wall and walk toward the center. Once they would meet, after many days, they would marry. It is a beautiful and symbolic idea. They agree to pursue it once they are back in Amsterdam. Marina writes, "The sun went down and I began cooking, and as I cooked, we suddenly became aware of a huge wedge-tailed eagle circling us in the semi-darkness. He circled and circled, and then he landed, directly across the fire from us. He just stood there and looked at us. This was a really big bird. I stopped cooking. I couldn't move. The image of this giant bird standing and staring at us was so mesmerizing. We didn't move. We never ate. We just left our food. As the darkness deepened, the eagle continued to stand there. We fell asleep. We woke at first light and saw the eagle still standing in the same place, stock still. And then, I'll never forget this, Ulai walked over to the bird and touched it, and it fell over, dead. It had been entirely eaten by ants. Every inch of my body turned to goosebumps. We packed our things and got out of there fast. Unquote. Months later, Marina and Ulai had finished their stay with the Aborigines, and they were having dinner in Alice Springs with Philip Toyne and an anthropologist named Dan Vachon. They were sharing stories with them about the dreams, the strange coincidences, the rituals, and the medicine man. Ulai mentions, "Oh, and Watuma, the medicine man, gave me this name, Jungarai." The anthropologist looked surprised. He pulled up a dictionary of the Aboriginal language and said, "Let me look that up." His finger tracing the pages, once, then twice. It was a compound word, like an adjective and a noun placed together. He finally arrived at an answer. "Oh, that means dying eagle." They stared in disbelief. Chapter 6, Sublimation. 1981. Marina and Ulai are back in Western civilization again. It's been a few weeks since their six-month stay with the Aborigines, but they are still trying to process what happened. What did they learn? How to be still? How to be hungry? How to be silent? Somehow, they feel that their new mission is to bring some of this experience back with them into the modern world, to show modern and Western audiences this other way of existing, this more ancient way, and they will do it through their art. They conceive of a new piece, which they title Gold Found by the Artists. The title is both literal and metaphorical, as they had actually found a handful of gold while in the desert, but also the experiences with the Aboriginal tribes were themselves pure gold. They begin to wonder if they could perform a work that requires them to sit and stare at each other for a very long period of time. If they did this, would it re-engage that state of consciousness they experienced while in the outback? Would they perhaps be able to communicate through thought as well? Marina writes, "The new piece would go as follows. For 8 hours, we would sit across a table from each other, in chairs that were neither too comfortable nor too uncomfortable, and look into each other's eyes without getting up, without moving at all. On the table, we placed a gold-covered boomerang, the gold nuggets we'd found in the desert, and, once again, a live snake, a 3-foot diamond python named Zen. The snake symbolized life and the Aborigine creation myth. The objects stood for our time in the outback. Sitting unmoving all day sounds simple. It was anything but simple. At our first performance, we found out how hard it would be. The first day, at the Art Gallery of New South Wales in Sydney, everything was fine for the first 3 hours. But then the big muscles in our legs, thighs, and calves began to cramp, and our shoulders and necks began to throb with pain. Yet our commitment to remaining still meant that any kind of movement to relieve the pain was impossible. The experience is indescribable. The pain is a huge obstacle. It comes like a storm. Your brain tells you, well, I can move if I really have to, but you don't move. If you have the willpower to make no compromise or concession, the pain becomes so intense that you think you'll lose consciousness. And it's at that moment, and only at that moment, that the pain disappears. They plan to perform Gold Found by the Artists for 8 hours a day, 16 days straight, in a gallery in Sydney, Australia. During that time, they fast every day, all day, only consuming juice and water in the evenings, and never speak to each other. Every day is a new challenge, and a new array of pain. Some days it is in their shoulders, other days legs, other days it seems impossible to concentrate. As if the human body is not meant to sit still for these lengths of time, But all throughout, there are also moments of incredible transcendence and sublimation. Moments when thoughts cease, when existing is all there is. In one session, Marina stares at Ulai, and he disappears, only to be replaced by a pure blue light, which persists and remains even after she blinks multiple times. At the end of each day, Marina writes a short journal entry. On July 13th, she writes, "Difficult day. I wish to cry. I have pain everywhere. I'm not able to concentrate. How to make it till the end?" Unquote. On the next day, July 14th, something unexpected happens. Shortly after beginning the performance, Ulai stands up and leaves. Marina doesn't know why, but she continues the piece without interruption. Marina never breaks the rules of a piece. In her journal that night, she writes, "Afternoon, Ulai stood up all at once and left. A little later, someone came to me and put a small note in my hand from him. He wrote that I must decide for myself if I continue. His pain in his lower abdomen is so acute that he can't. I continue to sit. Light on his chair stays, two circles, and in the center, a bright point. After 7 hours, at home." Unquote. The performance, combined with the rigorous fasting, is taking a toll on their bodies. After 10 days, Ulai has lost 26 pounds. Marina has lost 22. She is worried about the pain Ulai is experiencing, so they go to a hospital. It turns out that Ulai's spleen is dangerously swollen. The doctor warns them that their bodies might begin to fail them if they continue. They look at each other and decide to continue. 6 days left. July 15th, Marina writes in her journal, "The next day, excruciating pain and sudden cramps continued. But with them came a new phenomenon, a 360-degree vision. I actually had the sense, like a blind person, that I could see what was happening behind me. But I wrote in my diary, I have less and less wish to write about all this. And then Ulai had to leave the table once more. Once again, I remain. I can deal with the pain more easily," I wrote that night. "Ulai again has the problem to continue. For me, it is incomprehensible. We said to ourselves 16 days, there's nothing to think about. We must continue. I hope for the best." Unquote. Ulai returns, and they finish the 16 days. But there is no doubt that something about this piece was more difficult for Ulai. He later admits in the documentary, No Predicted End, that he was more suited to the physicality of their earlier work, that this sitting still proved especially difficult for him. Marina says that one reason for this is simple anatomy, that as a woman, Marina has more flesh on her butt. While by this point, Ulai has become so thin that his hip bones are in almost direct contact with the chair, pressing into his muscles and skin. Maybe it's the frustration of the work or an imbalance between them, but there's something about this piece which calls up a degree of conflict between them, especially outside of the performance space. In Ulai's mind, this piece is a continuation of their relational work. If he departs due to an inability to continue, then the piece itself loses meaning, and Marina should depart too. But Marina doesn't see it that way. In her opinion, the work has an absolutist quality, and if one of them can continue, it must continue, because those are the rules of the piece. And Marina never breaks the rules of a piece. They return to Amsterdam after completing the 16 days with a renewed sense of purpose. They decide to change the name of their new piece, Gold Found by the Artists, to Night Sea Crossing, a symbolic phrase representing crossing into the unconscious. In 1982, from March to September, they do multiple performances of Night Sea Crossing over 49 days. In Amsterdam, Chicago, New York, Toronto, Germany, and many others. But following their performance in Lyon, France, something snaps. Once again, Ulai had to stop performing because of intense pain in his butt and abdomen. He rises in the middle of the 8 hours, and Marina continues the piece alone. Marina writes, "Before the performance, we argued. It was the same fight as before. I felt strongly that the integrity of the piece took precedence over any personal considerations. It was the same fight, only this time, it escalated into screaming. And then all at once, Ulai slapped me, hard, in the face. This was not a performance piece. This was real life. It was the last thing I was expecting. The slap stung, tears came to my eyes. It was the first and last time he ever hit me in anger. He later apologized, but a boundary had been breached." It's clear that there was some issue brewing in the dynamic between them. The irony of it is especially clear in hindsight. Years ago, during the Art Vital days, They were performing intense and aggressive works, where they were slapping and hitting each other in the performance space. But in private, they were in perfect harmony. In the documentary, No Predicted End, Ulay says he was very equipped for their first series of performances, but less equipped for the long durational style of the Night Sea Crossing performances. Now they were performing a work that involved intense stillness, the lack of any action at all except the mutual connection, and yet, in private, there were unconscious forces eating away at the relationship. It is as if the earlier pieces acted as an outlet for the natural aggression and anxieties which arise in a relationship. But now, with the new restraint, those feelings have no outlet and have time to fester. They would perform this piece, Night Sea Crossing, a total of 90 times over the next 5 years. The irony of it is, the public begins to see them as a perfect couple, the two artist lovers. But in reality, with each performance, they are now growing apart. In 1982, on their joint birthday, November 30th, Ulay receives a call from Germany. His mother is dying. He leaves to see her at once and stays in Germany for a few days. She dies. He calls Marina and asks her to join him to attend the funeral. Marina travels to Germany and she writes, "That night, he told me he wanted to conceive a child with me. I refused, for the same reason as before. I was and would always be an artist, absolutely. Having a child would just get in the way. And now, not having a child was one more thing in the way of my relationship with Ulay." Unquote. At the end of the year, they feel they need a break and go for a meditation retreat in India for a month. There they meet the Dalai Lama and practice Vipassana meditation. Once they are back in Amsterdam, they file a proposal to realize another performance piece, which came to them during their time in the Australian outback, the Great Wall Walk. But in the process of planning it, they speak of the original premise to marry at its center less and less. But they know this will be an important work, one which needs to happen. Marina writes, "The truth is that my relationship with Ulay was falling apart. Our transition from frequent and ardent lovers to a couple living in mere physical parallel had begun with Night Sea Crossing. The performance required abstinence and distance during our off hours. And Ulay wanted so badly to do the piece all the way through, but he kept having to stop, which was killing him, and which distanced us even further. And we were still performing the piece here and there, trying to reach our goal of doing it 90 times. He was taking his humiliation out on me. He would flirt with waitresses, airline stewardesses, gallery assistants, anybody, right in front of me. I feel certain, in retrospect, that he was having affairs." Unquote. In the summer of 1984, Marina has an affair. She's invited to teach a course at the San Francisco Art Institute. Ulay is also invited, but passes on the opportunity and stays in Amsterdam. Marina's affair is with a mutual friend of theirs named Robin Winters, who is also teaching at the Institute that summer. Marina is nearing her 40s now, and she feels Ulay is pulling away, both emotionally and sexually. This fling fills a certain psychological need for her, but it also leaves her riddled with guilt. Coincidentally, Ulay is also having an affair at the same exact moment back home. When Marina returns, Ulay picks her up from the airport, and she breaks down and confesses everything to him. She says it's the first time she has ever been unfaithful to him. Marina writes about this moment. "His response amazed me. He was calm, he was sympathetic. 'I understand,' he said. 'Don't worry, everything is fine.' I thought, wow. Maybe the tantric discipline really has worked wonders for him. This is the greatest man I've ever known. How inconceivable, how beautiful, that he really understands." Unquote. The next day, she learns from her friends that Ulay had lived with a girl from Suriname, in their home, the entire time that Marina was away. From 3 days after she left until the morning she returned. She goes home to confront Ulay. "Is this true?" He tells her a strange story that he met this Suriname girl at a gallery opening, and they went out for a bite to eat, but they both got food poisoning, so they both had to get their stomachs pumped at the hospital, and afterward, he invited her to stay at their home. Marina writes, "He was actually trying to enlist my sympathy. Instead, I went totally nuts. And when I ran out of things to smash, I re-smashed what I'd already smashed. It would have been one thing if he'd confessed to me when I confessed to him, but to leave it all on me and pretend he was above it all, the arrogance or cowardice of it was breathtaking. After smashing a final dish, I walked out and went to stay with friends. After a day, I came home to pack, and then I moved out for good, and I went to India. He came to India after me, and we started again. All my friends told me it was a terrible idea. I should have listened. Unquote. All this time, they are still arranging for the performance of their Great Wall Walk, a piece which they call The Lovers. There are elaborate legal and logistical issues with the piece, which have delayed it for years, due to the Chinese government being hesitant to allow foreigners to be the first people to walk the entire length of the Great Wall of China. It takes considerable communication between the Dutch government and the Chinese government to make any progress every step of the way. The bitter irony of it is that the more the Great Wall of China performance materializes, the more distant Marina and Ulay are becoming. At this time, in the mid-1980s, Marina and Ulay are considered to be the perfect artist couple, the archetypal lovers, like the symbolic tarot card that bears the same name. The famous Rider-Waite tarot shows the lovers standing side by side, nude, echoing Adam and Eve. Behind Eve, on the left, is the tree of knowledge, with a serpent ascending it to Eve's ear. Behind Adam, on the right, is a fiery tree of life, echoing the arrangement of the Sephirot on the tree of life in Kabbalah. In between them is a mountain in the distance. Above is a divine angelic force, an emanation of the divine that connects their fate, as if in blessing. And directly behind this figure is a blazing sun. This card represents the first years of Marina and Ulay's relationship so well. It even implies the travels which they would embark on, with the mountain in the distance. But now, in the mid-1980s, their relationship more closely resembles the Devil card, most famously known for its representation in the Rider-Waite deck, where the nude figures of Eve and Adam are chained by their necks to an obsidian stone on which the devil is perched. Their fates are entwined, but not by a benevolent force, but an energy of chaos and darkness. It is also said the Devil card represents plans and schemes that one lover puts in motion behind the back of their partner. The complete darkness they are in can symbolize the darkness of the unconscious. What makes it doubly bizarre is that Marina and Ulay would become known for their performances being in the nude, like depicted in both cards. And paradoxically, directly above the devil's head and in between his horns is emblazoned an inverted pentagram, the same symbol which Marina carved into her stomach in her performance of Thomas Lips. It was also the first time they truly connected, directly after Marina's Thomas Lips performance in 1975, when Ulay was tending to her wounds, applying ointment to the inverted pentagram carved into her stomach. How bizarre that these two cards, the lovers and the devil, somehow encapsulate the two forces in Marina and Ulay's relationship. Aside from the complications of their personal baggage and their passing quarrels, there seems to be an existential dilemma at the heart of their relationship. Again, like an enormous devil between them, in the darkness of their unconscious, which cannot be reconciled. Ulay wants them to have a child. Marina doesn't want a child. This issue, in many ways, determines the nature of their reality. When both partners want it, a child is hope for the future. A child is family and roots. A child solidifies a spiritual union. Again, when both partners want it. But when one partner doesn't, what does that do? In her memoir, Marina admits to holding a secret fear that if they had a child, it would cause Ulay to leave, because she knew that he had already abandoned one child and marriage in Germany. She also felt that a child would take away from her ambitions, and the added fear of being a single mother turns it even more into an impossibility. The author, James Westcott, spoke with Ulay for his book, When Marina Abramovich Dies, and gives us more details from his perspective. He writes, "During a meeting one day at their apartment with the director of the Groninger Museum, who was interested in buying an Abramovich Ulay Polaroid, a young couple appeared at the door. They were dressed in motorcycle clothes and asked to see Ulay. 'Please refresh my memory,' Ulay said, not recognizing either of them. 'I'm your son,' the young man said. It was Mark Alexander, visiting unannounced from Germany. The people from the museum left in a hurry. Ulay had last seen Mark Alexander in the late 70s on one of his and Marina's occasional visits to Germany. Now he was a grown man." Unquote. An even more severe shock comes in June 1987. Marina writes, One day, Christine Koenig returned from town and told me she'd ran into a friend who said, I saw Ulay's son, and he's looking more and more like him. Which son? I asked. The only son I knew about was in Germany. When I asked Ulay if it was true, if he had another son in Amsterdam, he denied it, saying people were gossiping and trying to break us up. Unquote. The author, James Westcott, writes, shortly afterward, Ulay met his son, Jurian, for the first time. It was very strange, but not so exciting as everybody expected, recalls Jurian, who shares his father's taciturn yet charming nature, as well as being a physical carbon copy. Jurian had always known who his father was and what he did for a living. Unquote. For Marina, this was the final straw. Who was this man she had been with for over 10 years? And how could he have failed to mention he had a second son, one in the same city they lived in? This revelation threw everything into question. If he could hide something so important from her, what else could he hide? Ulay told this to the author, James Westcott. She didn't know about a very important part of me, and neither did I, because I did not have contact with Jurian. It didn't matter so long as she didn't know. It was blanked out. I never had the feeling that it would be a big issue. It was not about being secretive, but maybe more because of the feeling of shame. Because if I'd have mentioned Jurian, then I would have had to admit that I am a bad father. I was a bad father, for the same reason that Marina didn't want to have children. I had given priority to my artistic career. I couldn't combine my role of being a father with my outrageous career. Unquote. James Westcott posits that by choosing not to tell her about Jurian, Ulay had deliberately planted a time bomb in his relationship with Marina. He must have known that it would go off at some point and that it would probably blow open an exit route from the relationship. While the secret festered for 10 years, it also provided a point of differentiation from Marina. Holding something back was a way of guaranteeing that the relationship wouldn't swallow him up completely. In late March 1988, Marina and Ulay arrive in China to prepare for their monumental walk across the Great Wall of China. The piece, which they had first conceived 8 years earlier, in the Australian outback, which they called The Lovers. They meet for a quick photo op, and as they part, they only exchange the simple words, good luck. On March 30th, 1988, Marina steps onto the head of the dragon, walking west. At the same moment, in a different time zone, Ulay steps onto the tail of the dragon, walking east. The wall is thousands of miles long. They will each walk half of the length over the course of 3 months and meet at the center. When they finally meet, they will not marry as originally intended. Instead, this will be their final performance and the final farewell to their relationship. A film crew follows both of their journeys. The walk is documented in the film The Great Wall, Lovers at the Brink. On June 27th, 1988, they finally see each other in view. Two tiny figures on distant portions of that enormous ancient wall. They have both been walking 90 days, equivalent to the amount of days they performed Night Sea Crossing. 90 days suffering through various challenges and countless obstacles, much like their relationship in recent years. They have finally arrived at the destination, the bitter end. As they approach each other, Marina carries a red flag and Ulay a white flag. She is dressed in a red hiking outfit and Ulay in all blue. Ulay opens his arms wide. Marina walks into the embrace, almost as a formality. The cameras are rolling, and this moment is obviously intended as the climax of the documentary, the climax of a piece that is 8 years in the making. But you can read it on her face. For Marina, this moment is not a performance. Now, this is life. They separate, and Ulay begins to talk, as if to fill an awkward silence, saying things about his journey, about the strangeness of it all. But Marina just stares at him, with the look of someone who has just lost it all. She breaks eye contact for a few moments, and hides her face behind the red flag. She says nothing. And then, she begins to weep. Ulay says, "Don't cry, we've achieved so much." But the look on Marina's face says it all. None of it matters anymore. From this moment, she is saying goodbye to everything, saying goodbye to their relationship, to their collaboration, to all of their best years together. And she is saying goodbye to herself, the self that she was with Ulay for 13 years. And she is 41 now. All those years now feel wasted. This is not an achievement. This is a moment of grief. Ulay leans in and whispers something in her ear. And for a few seconds, Marina smiles and looks into the distance, avoiding eye contact. But as another silence between them grows, her smile fades, and the grief sweeps in again. Her face contorts. Ulai sees the inevitable coming and mutters something with a hopeful smirk. Marina doesn't even look at him. She leans her head into the white bamboo flagpole, with both hands clenching it as if she might fall over, and she breaks down crying. After this moment, they plan to never see each other again. Chapter 7, Life Becomes Art. The year is 2010. The date is March 14th. A special exhibition is being held at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. It's called The Artist is Present. The star of the show is Marina Abramović. It's an exhibit that has been decades in the making. This is a career retrospective of her artwork. What makes this event historic is that MoMA has never dedicated its entire museum space in this way to any single performance artist. And even more than that, The Artist is Present is not only a retrospective, it is a performance itself. Marina Abramović is seated in the atrium of the museum, at the center of a rectangular space, specially designed just for this. She is now 63. Surrounding her, in the sprawling and cavernous halls of the museum, are displayed all the works of her 40-year career. Photographs, film clips, and audio recordings. And in some rooms, there are performers re-performing her works, live, to more fully convey to the museum goers the nature of performance art. While preparing for the exhibit, she tells this to a documentary film crew.
You know what is interesting? After 40 years of people thinking you're insane and you should be put in mental hospital, you finally actually get all these acknowledgements. Takes such a long time to take you seriously.
The retrospective spans her early years, the rhythm series, her 13-year collaboration with Ulai, and the solo work that followed in the years after. In effect, this is a celebration of her life's work. The organizers even managed to obtain a replica of the black Citroën truck which Ulai and Marina lived in for 3 years, painting the interior above the windshield with that special phrase, "Art is easy." But what gets the most buzz in the press and captures the curiosity of New Yorkers and tourists alike is the piece Marina is performing, a piece called The Artist is Present. The rules are simple. Sit across from Marina Abramović for as short or long a time as you wish. Maintain eye contact. No touching, no speaking. That's it. Marina sits on an armless wooden chair in the center of the airy atrium space. In front of her is a light wooden table, and across from her is an empty wooden chair. That's it. No knives, no razor blades, no gun, no wine glass, no snake. She has distilled the performance materials down to the bare minimum. Human connection. The raw experience of gazing into someone else's eyes without the social context that tells you to look away. How long would you stare at someone if given the permission to do so as long as you wish? What if they were staring right back at you? What is exchanged in this interaction? What does it mean to distill human connection down to a mutual gaze? Research studies in psychology show that when two people hold eye contact for an extended period of time, their brainwaves begin to fall in sync. A curious fact, but what does it mean? This piece is a social experiment at the largest scale. The local news morning shows have a field day questioning whether this can be called art. Even Marina herself questions whether this is art. But yet, she feels this is the piece that is right for this space. Just as her and Ulai, years earlier, would first explore a performance space without preconceived ideas and let it tell them what it wants. Marina will be here every day of the week, from opening to closing. The performance will last 3 months, exactly 736 hours. Curiously, 3 months is the exact total time of Night Sea Crossing and the duration of The Lovers, The Great Wall Walk. For 3 months, this will be her life. Each visitor will sit with Marina for any length of time they choose. The mutual gaze will hold until they decide to end it. Many people come, in total, 850,000. Many people sit with Marina, over 1,500. Some sit for 5 minutes, some sit for 5 hours. One man comes 21 times over the course of the 3 months, the first time sitting for 7 hours. You can imagine the anxiety of those in attendance who had to stand online for hours, not knowing when the person currently sitting might choose to end their turn, or if the person in front of them, who they just had become friends with, would be the one to sit for 7 hours, until closing time, ruining their own chances to participate. So many of these small tragedies play out in this seemingly simple set of rules. On some days, the line of visitors hoping to sit with Marina extends all the way to the front door. In the third month, there will even be people camping out overnight to get a head start for the next day's line. What are they hoping to experience? Are they truly fans, contemporary art lovers, or are they attention seekers hoping to get their 15 minutes of fame in front of the cameras? As people wait online every day, the inevitable questions arise. Is it really her? How can she sit still for 8 hours? The local morning news shows have a field day, floating a theory that she must be wearing adult diapers. How can someone sit in one place for 8 hours and not pee themselves? What they don't know is that Marina began preparing for this piece a year in advance. She worked with a physician and nutritionist who developed a special regimen. Every day, she would start with a very early morning breakfast, no lunch, no water during the day, and a protein-rich meal at night. It's easily the longest preparation she's ever done for a piece, though the visual impression it leaves makes it all worthwhile. To see her sitting in her floor-length gown without moving, like a mountain, the stillness itself is so uncommon that it takes on mythic proportions. Each person that approaches Marina after waiting online enters the performance space and first sees her sitting with eyes closed. They sit down across from her, only a few feet, and within a few seconds, she slowly opens her eyelids, beginning the unbreakable gaze. She writes of this experience in her book, Walk Through Walls, saying, "I was there 100%, 300% for each person, and I became extremely receptive. As I'd noticed in Night Sea Crossing, my sense of smell was heightened. I felt I understood the state of mind Van Gogh achieved when he painted his paintings, when he painted the lightness of the air. I felt I could see, around each person sitting across from me, the same little particles of energy that he saw. Very early on, I realized the most amazing thing. Every single person sitting in that chair across from me left a specific kind of energy behind. The person left, the energy stayed. What I found immediately was that the people sitting across from me became very moved. From the beginning, people were in tears, and so was I. Was I a mirror? It felt like more than that. I could see and feel people's pain. I think people were surprised by the pain that welled up in them. For one thing, I don't think people ever really look into themselves. We all try, as much as possible, to avoid confrontation, but this situation was profoundly different. First, you wait for hours just to sit in front of me. Now you're sitting in front of me. You are observed by the public. You are filmed and photographed. You are observed by me. There is nowhere to go except into yourself. And that's the thing. People have so much pain, and we're all always trying to push it down. And if you push down that emotional pain for long enough, it becomes physical pain." Marina sits with her hands flat on her legs. She closes her eyes. The next person approaches the empty chair. They sit and settle themselves. Marina takes a breath, and her eyes slowly open. She sees a young Asian woman with long black hair tied back. The woman is holding something against her chest and shoulder. It's a baby. Marina writes, "On the morning of the first day, an Asian woman with a baby sat in front of me. The baby was wearing a little hood on her head, and I'd never seen anybody with so much pain in my life. Wow, she had so much pain. I couldn't breathe. She looked at me for a long, long time. And then she slowly took the hood off the baby, and the baby had a huge scar across the top of her head. Then she and the baby left. A year later, this Asian woman saw the book of portraits from the exhibition and wrote a letter to Marco and me, saying, 'I saw the book, and I wanted to tell you that my baby was born with brain cancer, and she'd had chemotherapy. On that particular morning, just before I came to MoMA, I went to the doctor and he said to me, "There is no hope anymore." So we stopped chemo. In a way, I was relieved that she would not suffer further, because the chemo was so terrible. But at the same time, I also knew that this was the end for my baby. So I came to sit with you, and this photograph was that moment. It was unbelievably sad. I wrote her back. A year passed, and then she sent me another letter saying, I am pregnant again. We've stayed in touch, and her new baby is okay. Life goes on. Marina sits with her hands flat on her legs. She closes her eyes. The next person approaches the empty chair. They sit and settle themselves. Marina takes a breath, and her eyes slowly open. She sees Ulay. How is this possible? Is he a hallucination? The look of surprise betrays her composure. In an instant, the memories rush in. The best years of her life were spent gazing at that face. For a moment, it is like Ulay is tending to her wounds again. A pure smile brightens her expression. Taken aback, she casts a bashful glance downwards, breaking the gaze, then raises her eyes again. Ulay gives a little shake of his head and shoulders. Closing his eyes for a moment, he smirks as he opens them again, as if to say, it's been a while since we last did this. Let's try again. Marina and Ulay settle their gaze on each other. Marina's chest rises and falls as she breathes heavily, and Ulay shakes his head, blinking his eyes as if to say, I know. It doesn't take long, and both of their eyes tremble with feeling, holding back tears. After another minute, Marina is breathing from her open mouth, and her eyes are bloodshot. She lets out a deep sigh that drops her shoulders as the tears stream down. This is no longer art. This is no longer life. This is both. Marina leans forward slowly and brings her hands onto the table, reaching towards Ulay. He breaks out in laughter and leans forward. As his hands clasp Marina's, she smiles completely. They hold this pose for a long time, gazing into each other. Marina has broken the rules of her piece. This concludes the Marina series. Wow, what a wild ride. I really think it's one of the best stories in contemporary art. There's gotta be a screenplay out there about it, just waiting to be made, right? I mean, imagine the Ulay and Marina art vital years, living in a van, stealing a painting from an art museum, evading the police, traveling Europe doing performance art shows, unconditional love. There's even a puppy in there. It has all the ingredients of an indie film ready for Sundance. What I didn't find time to say in the episode, perhaps because I didn't want to insert myself into the story in a selfish way, is that I was present for one of the performances mentioned in the episode. I was a museum visitor for Marina's The Artist is Present performance at the MoMA here in New York. It was 2010, and I was a college student at the time, and I distinctly remember waiting on that line for hours for a chance to sit with her, even though I didn't know anything about her at the time. But something drew me to that strange experience. So uncommon. I made it to the atrium, where I was about 20 feet from Marina, and there were still about 20 people in front of me online. It's there that I noted she was sitting as still as a mountain, and the incredible loudness of that stillness. I had to make a choice, though. There were only 2 hours left before the museum was to close, and there were still 20 people in front of me. I had already waited several hours. What was the likelihood the people in front of me would each sit for only 5 to 10 minutes? And what was the likelihood one of them would sit for 2 hours? And around me, there was an entire museum filled with a retrospective of Marina's work. It felt like a fool's game. What would you have done? I stepped off the line, gave up my spot to the person behind me and the 100 people behind them, and I went to enjoy the exhibition. It was the best decision I could have made. It was also the first time I was exposed to real performance art, and it left a mark on me which has not faded since. But I have to wonder, what do you think it means that she broke her rules when Ulay appeared? What does that mean in the full scope of her work and in her personality? Does it mean she was no longer the same Marina? It's something I can't help but think about. Let me know what you think. Another curious point. I now know a little about how long the artist is present must have felt, and how long the Great Wall Walk felt, and the total duration of the Night Sea Crossing performances, because in completing this Marina series, I've also been working on it for exactly 3 months. 3 episodes, 3 hours, 3 months. Life is funny. On that note, thank you to everyone who listens and shares the show. Even if I didn't have any listeners, I would probably still be doing this. But this is all so much more fun knowing you guys are listening. If you'd like to join our mailing list and get a gentle update when a new episode is released, just head over to mjdorian.com/mail. That's mjdorian.com/mail. Signing up is free, no spam, no BS, and I will never share or sell the email list. The link for that is also in the episode description. Now, I'd like to send out some special thank yous. In completing this series, I am indebted to Marisa Ferdensi, who served as audio editor for all 3 episodes. She did such an incredible job, and without her, I would still be editing this series for another month. No joking. If you want to hear her work as a singer and songwriter, go check out her phenomenal band called City Girl. That's one word. I've included a link to her band's Instagram in the episode description. Thank you, Marisa. And now, some shoutouts are in order for my Patreon supporters. First up, sending a special handshake and thought to my executive producer in the Dreammaker tier, Mike Hill. Thank you, Mike. Sending you love. Sending big thank yous to my Karma Coma supporters, Adana, Brian Drury, Christel82, Cryptic Hubris, Don Frias, Isaac Abizadeh, Josh Smith, Julio Chavez, Chris with a K, Marav Seren, Misha, Michael Thompson, Miss Alex Kennedy, Mona Oman, Russ Jones, Sam McCohey, Stephen Hunter, Vandan Panchal, Denise Stevens, Sarah J, and Renat. It's an honor to have your support. Thank you so much. Next, shoutouts to my Shadow Fam Plus crew, Aaron Knight, Ben Thernhofer, Blake Huggins, Brittany Miller, Cerise Walker, Donna Toms Jones, Frank Warren, Fred, Grain of Sand, Helena DiMarzio, James SZ, Jane Van Elk, Jeremy, Joe Russell, John Bergmans, John Harrington, Karina, Casey Vandenberg, Ken Goodyear, Lane Zong, Logan Kshivitsky, Luis Benton, Lyle Vincent, Maria, Matt Seibert, Michael Gaffrey, Michael Pisano, Nicole Locilento, Nicole Chen, Rebecca Redding, Ryan Huff, Sean Matthew Howard, Steve Struhar, Tyler McKenzie, Hugh July, Luis Cornejo, Ruben Corona, Susan Maggie, Susie Cream Cheese, Tom Rubens, Deborah Myers, Nuit Dor, Angela Lau, Daisy Hernandez, Doxy, Jenna Cooper, Kevin Connell, Kirsten Dressler, Lyndon, Owen McAteer, Sarah Tucker, Talia Gallegos Fada, The Celestial Room, Tom Ney, SEQ, Michael Hildbold, Zachary C. Hildum, Holly Clark, Sebastian Flores, Kelly McGuire, Ivana Marie Goroyska, Hope Williams, Dana, Courtney Lewis, Melusine Shaw, James Gustafson, Natalie W., Veronica Pescatelli, Caitlin Mac Grady, Min Yi Chung, Philip Boithelet, John Rayburn, Barrett Riker, Rebecca Sunday, Juliana Cheplik, Caleb Stevens, Asia O'Brien, Brando, Fegan Byram, Gary Strack, Isaac, Jason Coleman, Maul the Mage, Michael McGee, Mike Townsend, Mirna Kay, Nathan Phelps, Neil Buss, Paisley Vader, Robert Jenkins, Sasha, Shane Breslin, Ty Cayetaneto, Tyler D, Vinny and Nina, and Wazzo. Thank you so much, guys. I couldn't do this without you. And the thank yous for all you fine Shadow Fam folks are written in the episode description. I appreciate you too. The next series is going to be about Dr. Carl Jung and alchemy. What happens after the Red Book? Why does Jung never finish the project? We'll find out. This has been Creative Codex. I am your host, MJ Dorian. Until next time, remember, every creative act is an act of courage.